broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. In the strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the bloom or blight, parts the goats upon the left hand and the sheep upon the right. And the choice goes by forever twixt the darkness and that light. Hast thou chosen, O my people, on whose party thou shalt stand, ere the doom from its worn sandal shakes the dust against our land? Though the cause of evil prosper, yet 'tis truth alone is strong, and albeit she wander outcast now, I see around her throng troops of beautiful tall angels to enshield her from all wrong. James Russell Lowell, from his poem, The Present Crisis, printed in the Boston Courier, December 11, 1848. With me today to begin our discussion of politics and literature are Don Rush, news director for Delmarva Public Radio, and Dr. Adam Wood, department chair and associate professor of English at Salisbury University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Don. We're going to talk about politics today and its expression in literature, and particularly fiction and poetry. Now, politics is certainly an activity of choosing and managing governing bodies, but it's much more than that. For the benefit of our discussion, how would we define politics today?
Well, politics reaches back to the Greeks, right, with the polis, which was, of course, the city-state. And the thing about the Greeks is that they formed this idea that the community, that is, the polis itself, was one of the ultimate expressions of life and city-state in terms of life itself. I mean, Aristotle comes to the conclusion that he believes actually that public life is far more virtuous than, say, the private life, and therefore the politics becomes extremely important, that we are basically political animals, that we interact with one another, and we do it on a community basis. And you could see, as you reach back, you can see a great debate that goes on in terms of what it means to be part of a community and the dynamics, the internal dynamics of the community. I mean, you get everything of certainly the great Greek plays, Antigone, which talks about, of course, a higher law as opposed to the law of the state, and even a lot of the conflicts that occur in terms of the ruling families and their assassinations, or somebody's being, for instance, Oedipus Rex is an example. You get the fates imposing themselves on this structure, this political structure. So they're still talking about the dynamics within a state. We, of course, think of now of a nation state. So when you think about politics, we really are talking about a public square. Although there's obviously, we often talk about the office politics, which I guess is another form right. of a public square, although not the one we usually think of. And I suppose that any interaction, I suppose, can really be defined as politics. But I think for our purposes, it's that politics of the community, that interaction that takes place, whether it's on a governmental level or it's a movement level, whatever happens to be the case in terms of the issue that you're dealing with. So for our purpose, I think that's really where politics gets defined.
And we're talking about politics as a decisional activity. Generally, the interaction issues in some kind of a decision that comes out of that. Am I correct? tier, would you say?
Well, certainly in part it's a governing process. You know, the Greeks, for instance, talked a lot about, monarchies as opposed to democracies. And I remember reading Aristotle talking about how monarchies were the best when they ruled best, and they were and democracies were the worst, you know, when they and if you were ruling worst. So there was a great deal of discussion, great deal of concern about how people interrelate in terms of society within Greek society. And then that seems to then, of course, obviously that debate continues on to the Romans and so on and so forth. And even today we saw, for instance, the rise of nationalism, particularly in the 1800s, where you had this major shift from monarchy, which had been basically the basic form of government for hundreds of years, thousands of years for that matter, to a nation state in which all these people were participating. You suddenly had a public opinion that you had to deal with now. Certainly in the 1800s, for example, you saw the rise, for instance, a particular rise of what I might call nationalistic anti-Semitism, which was much different than the anti-Semitism that occurred before, prior to that. So then we then look at the 20th century, we so see the emergence of the nation state. And I think that if the Greeks were looking at it, the ancient Greeks were looking at it now, they would recognize this, but of course on a scale of they could never imagine as just a small city-state.
Adam?
Yeah, you're totally right, Don. I mean, the one thing that I would sort of add, even thinking about sort of the Greek city-state, is that, you know, politics is a question of certain choices that are made, but certain actions as well. I think the other thing to sort of keep in mind is even in the, you know, the notion of sort of the Greek city-state, not everyone was allowed to be involved in politics. And so I think politics is often, if not always, also questions of who gets included in the choices, who is excluded from that, and what sort of recourse the excluded groups have. You know, and so again, if it's not a question of having a choice in the system, what sort of activities can there be from underrepresented groups in terms of those politics? And so, you know, I think when we think about, we talk about student movements from the 1960s or even some of the student movements that we're seeing today, go towards questions of feeling excluded from the political process and how to make one's voice sort of heard in that sort of sense.
Well, I just read in the current issue of The New Yorker, David Remick's piece on President Trump and the 100 days. And he ended with a phrase that I thought was kind of interesting. And he suggested was that what we have today is a transactional view of politics, and he didn't go on to explain that. He kind of assumed that we would know what a transactional view of politics is from this administration. What would you take his meaning to be, Don or Adam? You either.
I don't know that piece particularly, but I'm wondering if it's a question of a shift to a focus on the more of the individual perspective in politics, that instead of sort of thinking of the larger polis, you know, as Don mentioned, if it was a matter of, well, what can I personally get out of this? And so perhaps that's the sense of that sort of transaction of, well, if I give my vote, what do I get in return?
I was sort of thinking, and it was a new phrase to me as well. So I had to think about it. And I kind of thought, well, what would be on the other side of a transactional politics? I kind of got the sense that what Remnick might have been talking about in terms of this administration is dealing politically with issue by issue by issue. For instance, working on the jobs activity at the carrier plant was a transactional kind of politics. And what I kind of saw is and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong here, I thought as the other side of that might have been a policy-driven politics, where instead of thinking about saving 800 jobs at Carrier, you think about how to establish a policy that is going to reach out and establish thousands of jobs at many, many different companies. Would that be an expression of transactional politics?
Well, I think my first blush is that maybe more to be specific is ideology. Mm. And that is that the political parties certainly are driven by ideology, various ideological platforms, ideas. Whereas I think the reference to particularly Trump is a businessman in which everything is transactional.
Right.
That is that, you know, it's not a matter of some set of ideals as what can you get, what you can't get, et cetera. I mean, that's the kind of thing that he is usually involved with. So, for example, we have the great debate about health care. There's no real great debate about, at least from the administration or talk about the administration, what the particulars are of that health care plan. The idea is to get it through, to get a win sort of on the board. That's transactional as opposed to, say, somebody saying, no, I think that I don't want any government, for instance, involvement in health care. That's an ideological position. As opposed to, say, Trump, who at one time favored, for instance, a single-payer system. Right. He thought that might work, or maybe something else might work. He'd like to have everybody covered. But he had no ideological framework to say, okay, these are the markers I want to achieve. As opposed to many of the people, for instance, the Freedom Caucus is an example, they want it all stripped out, and they have a much different view of the role of government, whereas he's kind of got this kind of mixed feeling about, well, maybe we can cut a deal somehow, rather than necessarily that, I mean, because you always hear, particularly you hear him, and I hear his White House spokesman talk about how, you know, we're going to have a great deal in this piece of legislation, it's getting better and better and better,
right.
Rather than, well, we have to make these agreements and deals in order to get the thing through. Those are two much different things.
Sort of the politics of right now as opposed to the long game in some ways.
Well, Adam, we're talking politics and literature today, and we're particularly interested in the literature of fiction,
right.
and also of poetry. What is literature, and how do we begin to talk about literature?
You know, this is sort of one of the classic difficult questions. In the purest sense, we might say that, you know, literature, be it poetry or fiction, is sort of a creative and aesthetic use of language that draws attention to the artfulness of it while expressing the lived condition of people in a particular historical moment. Of course, the problem with even defining literature becomes a political problem in terms of who has the voice to decide what gets counted as literature. I mean, it's not surprising when you think of the three supposed greatest authors, Milton, Chaucer, Shakespeare. They all seem to have one sort of thing in common, which is sort of their dead white maleness. And when they were decided that they were the greatest writers of all time, they were chosen by, at the time, live white men who've sort of become dead white men. And so, you know, it's interesting, even that question of what is literature in the proper sense becomes a political question in some ways. It's not the overt politics of voting for a candidate, but is very much sort of a political implication. And we've seen it sort of change over time. What is prioritized in the literary changes over time. Think about the high modernists. You know, we had writers like T.S. Eliot who were very reactionary and very conservative, and they seemed to champion literature that was devoid of emotion, and they felt sort of devoid of momentary politics, almost in the way that Don was talking about, where that definition has sort of gone out of style. I think in the simplest sense, you know, the question of how do we recognize the literary is with particular uses of language, right? Language that we don't encounter on the street. There's a great British thinker who has an example that, you know, he says when you see a street sign that says, you know, dogs must be leashed at all times. We don't think about the complexity of that language, and yet, you know, we can make literary jokes about that. But very often I think it is language, you know, written language that is drawing us to the fact that it's doing something different than standard language normally does for us.
Does that have anything to do with talking about more universal themes or emotions, or is that passé?
I think there, you know, there is something to that a great literary text does convey something beyond whatever the events and characters, for example, that might be in it. But at the same time, I think one of the more recent sort of notions in literary studies is that there are a lot fewer, perhaps, of these universal experiences than we'd like to believe, that different communities and different generations and genders and any number of things sort of have very different experiences. And, you know, do we all fall in love the same way? Do we all experience, you know, politics in the same ways? And so I think that there can be things that sort of can unify in some ways through a broader sort of experience. I think in more contemporary literature, we're seeing perhaps the explosion of sort of newer voices, right? Newer experiences that have not been considered literary for the long time, not because they were any, you know, less well written, but because of the politics of literary publishing, even, you know.
Well, to put a little finer definition, maybe, literature, what would you see as the difference between, in the world of politics, for instance, the difference between literature and propaganda?
Well, you know, there's I don't think that there's a clear-cut distinction always between the two. I think there's some texts that we encounter that we recognize as obviously propaganda, right? You know, I mean, we can think of, you know, Ayn Rand's works that are clearly sort of right-wing propaganda, or we can think of something, you know, like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle that was sort of meant to be propaganda at the time from more of a left-wing perspective. And so, you know, when you encounter those texts, it's as if you're sort of being bludgeoned with them, right? You recognize two sentences in that these are texts with a very distinct political purpose, and that's what they're going to be doing sort of all the way through. Where I think, you know, all literary texts have, and this is a phrase borrowed from a thinker named Frederick Jameson, a political unconscious of a sort. And the notion with that is that even if they are not overtly political texts, because they're emerging out of a very specific historical and political moment, that they are by definition sort of political artifacts, and that we have to sort of almost sort of play a psychoanalyst to try to take these things apart and to sort of see the politics that are sort of buried underneath of them. And so again, I think there's a gray area between the two. You know, we recognize when they go too extreme on one side or the other, but I think a lot of texts exist in that sort of middle ground. And it also depends on your politics. If it's a more left-leaning text and you tend to be more right-leaning, you call it propaganda. And if it's a more right-leaning text and you're left-leaning, you call that propaganda. And so, you know, even in that, politics is interwoven at sort of every stage of the game, I think.
I thought that this opening piece by James Russell Lowell was interesting, though, in the sense that here Texas is about to be admitted to the Union. They're debating this, and it comes: are we going to take them in as a slave state? Or are we going to make them get rid of their slavery? And on the one hand, he hammers that, and I'm back to what is literature question. Right. He hammers that point, you know, but he puts it around a universal theme, which is at every moment you face some kind of decision that is bigger than even the issue. And then he takes that and applies that kind of need to decide and respond to his particular issue. So we've got a nice combination of literature and propaganda, right, because he's coming at convincing us to do act on this one particular
but he's lulling us in with the aesthetic. You know, he's bringing us in with the sort of aesthetic use of language. That, again, I think is, you know, one of literature's sort of great powers is to draw us into it without being overt, right? Yeah. If we find ourselves identifying with characters or situations, that's that sort of way in. And then when you get to sort of some of the more political or, you know, social justice, to use more contemporary terms, some of those things are more effectively sort of buried into the aesthetics. You know, I mean, when we confront something that is sort of overtly political in a place we don't expect it, I think we often sort of pull back from it, where I think the beauty of the the aesthetic text, you know, the well-written one, and there's a judgment call and somebody can get on my chops about that, is that it brings us into the narrative first and foremost, right? It brings us into the language, whatever it is, and then sort of immerses us into that sort of political question.
Well, you mentioned the jungle earlier and the muckrakers. Who were these people and what were they responding to? And Don, you jump in on this as well.
Well, the jungle was really comes out of this sort of progressive era, this idea that government can somehow fix the ills of society, the problems that we're facing, right? And so, for instance, with the jungle, we were talking about how meat, particularly, was processed. Now, when you read the book, it's almost to the end where he finally comes to confrontation, I believe, with some folks who were communists at the time, and he's even disillusioned with them at the very end. But it draws you in with all these really interesting characters and how precarious their positions are in society. So, you know, at the time, of course, Teddy Roosevelt thought that Upton Sinclair was a crackpot. Didn't like him because he was a socialist and so on. But it led to a whole series of pieces of legislation that, you know, including what would become the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. So you have these kinds of books. Ida Tarbell wrote the history of Standard Oil, which ultimately led to the breakup of Standard Oil, for example. And you had a whole bunch of these folks who were looking at using fiction in a way to critique the current conditions, and ultimately it spurred, of course, action. I mean, you can take a look, for instance, at Oliver Twist, which everybody knows is a sort of a musical and so on and so forth. Dickens wrote that as a critique of the workhouses.
Right.
That's exactly what he was getting at, that and how this revolution in which the kids were taken off the streets and put in workhouses, which was thought to be very progressive at the time. And he says, well, no, but you see, this is how they can be exploited, right? So he uses a really interesting novel, which, of course, all that's now really lost to us and current thinking in current day. But at the time, this was a critique of a particular system. And so so a lot of this literature, you'll get some results. You'll get changes in the laws. Right. And that was one of the reasons, you know, we think about our studies and so on and so forth in terms of modern day analysis of, you know, with lots of numbers and things like that. But people 100 years ago or 200 years ago, A, didn't have that kind of data, but B, they critiqued oftentimes through fiction, through literature, creating figures and stories that would then tell you about a particular issue. I mean, I can think of, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is probably one of the most influential American novels. Again, creating this critique of slavery and this iconic figure, which continues to this day, which is Uncle Tom. And if you read, for instance, her second book, which is Dread, which really raises the question about, well, can we reform slavery through some legal rights, right? But of course, at the end of the novel, she concludes that that's never going to happen. Slavery is too embedded, and you're only a few years away, of course, from the Civil War. So you get, you know, you get literature that will either spur movements, which certainly her book certainly did with the abolitionists, or actually changing laws in terms of things like the jungle.
I mean, it's interesting the sort of example of the jungle, really. Again, it's a text that is, I think, more propaganda than literature in the classic sense. And as you were just sort of mentioning that, Don, is because I think that there's only one option really in the book, right? It's not as if you can read The Jungle and think, well, I think we need less regulation in the beef industry or something like that. And so, you know, those kind of texts are heavy-handed, right? They sort of give us the answer, where I think that there are other kinds of texts that are sort of richer in confronting us to actually have to grapple with it ourselves. I mean, I think in terms of sort of favorite text of mine, which is Stephen Crane's Maggie, A Girl of the Streets, about sort of abject poverty in the Bowery in the late 19th century. And, you know, there's certainly a critique of sort of the hypocrisy of religion in dealing with the poor, hypocrisy of how the police deal with the poor. But the real power of the novel is that it is not sort of saying, well, if we can fix this one thing, poverty goes away. But rather brings the reader into that, right? Makes the reader in some ways culpable for, and spoiler alert, for Maggie's death in some ways, right? That she that the bigger problem, as Crane sees it, is less policy or politic, but rather sort of an indifference of human beings to each other, right? Which is a much more complicated sort of thing to put us on the spot, as opposed to the jungle, which says, well, let's have these regulations and then things get better in some ways.
So the jungle is you're feeling much closer to propaganda, perhaps. And that's not – propaganda is generally a pejorative word.
Right.
But we're using it here as a more benign, benevolent phrase, which is really the transfer of information and convincing someone
right.
to take a particular point of view.
Definitely, I don't think there's a whole lot that's subtle in the jungle.
Although I think the characterizations and so on of scenes, I think they're really remarkable, which makes it really interesting because you're right. We know where this is going in terms of you got to do something about this.
Right.
That's what it really says. You've got to do something. But all of the characters and the way it flows out and describes society brings you into a literary form. And not just simply a tract which says, okay, here are the numbers. Okay, so yeah, all these people are dying or whatever, so on and so forth, like we would do today, right?
Definitely.
We'd have a study, we have a report that says,
right, here's
okay.
Here's a graph.
Yeah, right, that's right.
Right. This was a usage of literature as a way to obviously, A, get something done, but B, it was more than just simply the usual tract, as it were.
No, I think you're right.
You know, I think so.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think we really saw the realist novel, I think, is really where this began to take off, right? I mean, we saw this in earlier poetry and in a number of kinds of texts. But with the birth of the realist novel, I think that there is more of that attempt to directly politicize the experience of these characters. I mean, I think about Theodore Dreiser once was reflecting on a big influence of his Balzac. And when he was sort of asked, what is it about Balzac that really sort of get you excited as a writer is, and he, I don't remember the exact quote, but he says something to the effect of Balzac's ability to convey both the center and the circumference, right? And So we think of the center as this our central character, our main character, whatever their experience is, but that we're not looking at their experience sort of in a vacuum, right? That they are always within the circumference of the world in which they live. And so, I mean, I think you're right that we have to be drawn into these characters. We have to find sympathy for them in some ways. But to attempt to give us that sort of broader image of the world, right? And I think about a lot of Dreiser's novels that begin not with a description of a character, but with a description of a very particular time and place, right? An American Tragedy sort of begins in a small Midwestern city, his novel. The Financier begins very distinctly in Philadelphia at a particular time. And so there's sort of that sense of – and again, I mean, this goes back to the question of that sort of universal – experience, right? Are there certain universal experiences that literature can convey? Yes, but they also convey something very specific about that time and place. And that realism, I think, has that ability to get that all in a way that maybe sort of previous literary forms couldn't quite do it.
How about the Grapes of Wrath? Now, that's not propaganda. I didn't get the sense that the novel is pushing for anything other than just a description of life in this period as seen through the Jodes.
Right.
You wouldn't call that propaganda literature, but
I don't know. I mean, because he gets involved with the union guys,
right.
Sinclair clearly has a certain amount of certain feelings, political feelings,
right?
I think even there with this great novel and there's some great descriptions, particularly the land, it's interspersed. There is this look at, you know, there's this disparity between rich and poor, between what's happening, particularly in the ground in the 1930s. I mean, I'm almost reminded that, you know, the guy who wrote Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald, almost does a flip side where he looks at the decadence of the wealthy. Right. And in Great Gatsby, it's basically, well, you know, they go around, they damage everybody and then they kind of run off. And everything's left behind, and he's again addressing this widespread difference between the wealthy on the one hand and those people who are just ordinary on the other. And then Grapes of Wrath, you're looking at, in this case, obviously the result of the Great Depression, but what happened to all of these people? Where do they come from?
No, I think you're right. And again, both are realist novels.
Yeah, exactly. Very different
in some ways. And again, it's not really surprising in a lot of ways that the realist novel really picks up steam and develops into sort of a dominant form with the Industrial Revolution.
Right? What was the period of the realist novels? Give us a setting here, Adam.
It came to America a bit later. Roughly starting the late or the early 18th century, sort of in some places, and you see it sort of really developing. But again, there's different forms of the realist novel. Again, we can think about Flaubert or Balzac, you know, when it comes to America. Again, we've got Stephen Crane, writers like Frank Norris or Theodore Dreiser. And in some of the research about the rise of realism, it has, even if we think about sort of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, was sort of a delayed event in some ways, right? This had happened in France a number of years before when Balzac was writing. And so we think about how those really key historical moments, those political moments as well, have a direct impact on even the form that literature takes. Capitalism, as a system, is sort of a totalizing system, right? I mean, we exist within that. And so I think to go back to that notion of the center as well as the circumference, that capitalism, particularly as it has become more and more of a global existence, we find ourselves immersed in it at sort of every turn. And so I think, you know, even Steinbeck, sort of a great example, that it's not an overt attack on capitalism the way Sinclair's The Jungle is, but a lot of the issues connected to poverty that Steinbeck is looking at do connect back to problems that he saw in capitalism, right? Now, Sinclair obviously wanted to chuck capitalism wholesale. Is The Grapes of Wrath an anti-capitalist novel in the same sort of way? I don't think so. And I think that's what makes it more complex than The Jungle in some ways.
Yeah, well, the whole you're alluding, Don, to the whole sense of the farm worker situation in The Grapes of Wrath.
Right, and right. I mean, they get tossed off their land because of the banks,
right?
And the banks now become, and during that period, I mean, that's one of the reasons why people who rob banks could become popular is because they were striking out against a common enemy, as it were. But yeah, no, so that you get. This is a critique. Yeah, this is a critique, I think, of capitalism. I don't think necessarily in the book, and I'm talking about his particular policies, but in the book, I don't think he's necessarily talking about tossing it out, but he's putting his finger on it saying there's something wrong here. As a matter of fact, during the 1930s, there was a good group. It's pretty interesting. There's a great deal of talk in the 1930s about revolution.
Right.
We've all forgotten that, but there was a, you know, like, what are we going to do? And Roosevelt comes in and says, okay, well, we're going to save it. And so he gets all these government programs and so on and so forth so that we can get from one point to the to the other, right? And in some ways, that's a reflection of the critique that, for instance, The Grapes of Wrath really points to in a broader sense in terms of capitalism.
Well, a phrase I've come up with, and maybe you can throw some light on this, because it may not well be an appropriate phrase, but I came up with the phrase of unintentional political literature. Mm-hmm. Unintentional political literature may actually be something like The Grapes of Wrath. It was written for another purpose other than a political expression, even though that shows up there. Can you think of such a thing as some unintentional political literature, which for me, again, is some fiction that was written, or even poetry that was written for a purpose other than political expression, but in fact turns out to have a significant political expression?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned the idea of the political unconscious earlier, and I think that there's, in some ways, a connection between those things. You know, I think a lot of times the politics of a text, when it's not propaganda, we don't recognize or talk about overtly until a number of years later, right? We can't see it sort of for what it was. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously something like The Jungle had a very immediate and hard sort of impact, right? It sort of made people think.
And was intended to.
Was, yeah, it was very much intended to. Where I think that there are, you know, other sort of texts that have really confronted us with how we think about the human condition. You know, I think about the sort of great shift in the late 19th century in America, at least, and this is true in Europe as well. You know, the advent of Darwinism, the realization that environmental factors can affect an organism, right? And so even if we think about something like poverty, to use an example we've been talking about, you know, for a long time the notion was, well, if somebody's poor, it's because they were just not good enough. You know, God helps those who help themselves or whatever it is. Where with sort of the development of Darwinian thought and some of the later thinkers to it, we realize that conditions have a very powerful influence on the development of individuals. And so a lot of these literary texts, I think, have started or started in the late 19th century, at least in America, to really focus on looking at those conditions, right? And even if they're not overtly political in that sort of way, calling for change, right, when we come to recognize the influence that conditions, environmental factors, any number of these things have on individuals, we begin to question, okay, well, what causes those environmental factors, right? If living in poverty is bad for people, and we can all kind of agree on that, what is it about that, right? And so, again, it's a shift from thinking, well, poor people are bad, and therefore they deserve to be poor, as, no, these people are poor because the conditions in which they exist have made them into certain kinds of individuals, but also that certain kind of systems, and again, I think this goes back to certain discussions of capitalism, require poverty, right? We have to have a certain level of poverty to make us get up and go to work every day, right? We don't want to think about it in that sort of sense.
Is that why I got up and went to work every day, Adam?
No one shoved a gun in your face to come in for this, I assume.
But Don, you had a... you had a novel that you mentioned at one time when we were talking that I kind of picked up on as at least a political expression. It was called Passing. I think I picked up as a political expression anyway. Say a few words about that.
Well, it's spinning off of what I was talking about, looking at conditions that people live in, right? And at the end of slavery, of course, there was this idea that African Americans would then rise through the ranks, that they had the Freedmen's Bureaus, and so on and so forth. And, of course, that didn't really happen.
Right.
And The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the themes is he was saddened to see that there had not been enough progress made. Mm-hmm. Right. So you get one of the interesting movements you get is what's called the New Negro Movement, which is basically an assertion of we want to leave behind the idea that you can just simply rise through the ranks economically, which was Booker T. Washington's approach, and much more of a W.E.B. Du Bois approach, which is, no, we have to break through in terms of politics, in terms of it, fuller expression. And so you see a lot of, particularly the writers, you see a lot of that expression in terms of confronting what W.E.B. called the color line. Now, the past is written by Nellis Parsons, and it centers around two basic characters. One, the central character is a woman. She's African American, but she can pass for white. Mm-hmm. Opening of the book, she actually goes into a restaurant that is for whites only, but she can pass, and she kind of looks around and she makes sure that nobody's noticed that perhaps she has some question about her. She has a friend of hers who can pass white altogether. Mm-hmm. And decides to do that. And one of the issues that it then raises is what cost does this occur? And as a matter of fact, you read about some of the literature and folks who did pass, one of the things that happens is that they have to leave behind everything. Right. That is to say that if they live in a white society, they can never go back, and they feel that they've lost something. And it's been this character who's now passing feels that. Obviously, throughout the novel, of course, she's drawn further and further back into her visits into the African-American community.
Right.
And in the end, of course, it all goes wrong. And what Parsons is doing is looking at human beings and how they operate in terms of their own private lives and their public lives. In this case, getting around, moving around, that kind of thing. So in the central character, she can pass occasionally. That's fine. She's married. She's actually married to a man who's clearly African American, who's constantly saying, "I got to leave this country. I have to get out of here." So you have these novels, particularly talking about, and Raya's really of some really interesting African American novels, Native Summon, so forth, looking at that color line that W.E.B. describes, and that. And as that movement like progresses, you can see then everything begins to pick up speed, and suddenly you're headed particularly the 1950s with the civil rights movement, and it goes on until finally there's a threshold from a political standpoint and from a social standpoint of breaking, of course, Jim Crow. But it has to start somewhere, and you get these sort of incremental things. There was another book I wish I could remember the author. Who also had who wrote about African Americans? I think it was in Washington D.C. And one of the central characters was somebody who could pass, and in the end, she's exposed in Washington society, and of course, completely destroys her. Everybody else is fine, but that person who's sitting in that twilight that Faulkner often talks about.
Oh, yeah.
They're the ones who wind up without anything.
There was a film a while back. I don't know if it came from a novel or not that hits on that exposure issue. I think it was called Pinky. And it was a woman who had passed, but then her heritage was exposed. And but one of the political, a very subtle political aspect of that story, Don, when you were telling it, is that her decision to be either black or white was a political decision.
Of course.
Of her own. And that's a unique sense of what a political novel expresses as well. My unintentional sense, because her choice was to choose a whole political system as opposed to another that she was going to participate in.
No, I mean, you're right. And there were certainly laws, you know, that dictated what you were. You know, we think
that's right.
The one drop law or any number of these things, where to be exposed for having even one of your great grandparents being black meant legally that you were black,
which
changed your entire experience in the world. I mean, one other thing I would add about that particular novel by Nell Larson's passing is that more recent discussions of it have looked at a sort of second layer of passing and suggested that the relationship between the two women in the novel is potentially sort of a potential lesbian relationship, and that in addition to these characters being African-American who are passing for white, they may actually also be homosexuals who are passing as heterosexuals. And so, and again, you know, some people would say, well, you know, maybe that's a contemporary imposition on the text. I think when you look in the text, there's certainly a sexual tension between these two female characters. But at the same time, if it was tricky to talk about race relations in passing in 1925 or so when this novel came out, discussions about homosexuality were even more taboo in some ways. And so you think about how artists, you know, really good writers have these sort of layers of it, right? That you're not even aware, perhaps, that you're being confronted with a political issue as much as sort of, oh, these are just issues about relationships between characters or any number of these sorts of things. And yet there are those moments where, you know, even a novel like Passing sort of lays itself bare. It's been a while since I've taught that novel. There's a moment where there are three black women who are passing for white who are having conversations and talking about kids. And the one woman says, well, I'd never want a kid. And the sort of question is why? And the response is, well, because it could come out looking black. And you realize sort of in that moment that terror, I mean, that real fear, that anxiety of bringing up a child in a racist world in that sort of way. And again, it's a political moment, but it's also just heartbreaking to think about not wanting a child for that sort of reason. And so again, I think it goes back to that sense of it's very much a political novel, but if we weren't drawn into the personalities and the sufferings of those characters, the politics can get lost.
Well, we started out with Lowell's The Present Crisis. Some people would say that today's present crisis is the political system, the nature of the political activity we find ourselves in. And I found it interesting that George Orwell's 1984 all of a sudden jumped to sixth place on Amazon's list of the most purchased novels, and because of the, I guess it came out of Kellyanne Conway's comment that there are alternative, facts, and that in fact is an expression that Orwell uses in 1984. So people, after her comment, ran to buy and reread the book about this totalitarian government that controls everything, even our thoughts, with the thought police.
I think the thing about the novel, is obviously about, it's about Stalin, you know, the Big Brother, and it's about the Soviet Union and so on and so forth. But the thing that carries a novel to this day is not fixating on a particular, even totalitarianism in and of itself, is the themes with which we see ourselves in society today. I mean, you're talking about alternative facts. We're talking about you can be at war with one person, with one country one day, and then suddenly it's right. The next day. We've had that sort of thing. You think about, you know, one of the things that is on the Ministry of Truth is the ignorance is strength. Well, we have this heavy anti-intellectualism goes
on. The opposite of the phrases. Yeah. The Ministry of Love.
That's right.
Which was the torture chamber.
Right. So that you get. So and if you look at political dialogue today, you can see these things going on, even though there's, to my knowledge, I highly doubt that we're going to be living in any kind of totalitarian society. But it does speak to the tendencies of societies, particularly modern societies, how information flows, how we relate to one another. The idea that we, for instance, we have in 1984, we have 2-minute hate, right?
Right.
Well, you know, we look back at the last election and we certainly see a lot of animus towards particular individual groups, right? We don't have to have a highly organized event, as I did in 1984. There's sort of this generalized event that goes on. And I think he's, in many ways, one reason why I think the novel like lasts beyond is simply that the blip of the moment in terms of totalitarianism is because it does identify those trends in society.
I think it focuses a lot on language, right?
Yeah.
The tyranny of language. This is how we speak about things, right?
Well, I'd like to suggest to both of you that even though 1984 is a significant precursor, that the novel that speaks more directly to our current situation is exactly Joseph Heller's Catch-22, rather than more so, let's say, than 1984. With Catch-22, we have this circular. We have so many things that it seems to me we're experiencing today. In Catch-22, the pilots were all off kilter by the circular logic that was expressed, and you know you couldn't there was no way to get grounded because you couldn't claim insanity. And that was the Catch-22, because if you went to the doctor and told him that you were crazy, so you couldn't fly, the doctor would say, well, that because you came here and told me, that means you're not crazy. Mm-hmm. And so you have to fly. And he says, well, what about Dobbs? And the doctor says, well, Dobbs is crazy. Yossarian, the character, says, well, why don't you ground him? And he says, I can. He said he's got to come to me and tell me he's crazy. And Yossarian says, that's all he has to do? And the doctor says, yeah, that's all he has to do. And Yossarian says, well, why doesn't he do that? And he says, because as soon as he comes and tells me he's crazy, that means he's not crazy and I can't ground him. And what happens, it's the whole issue in, I think, Catch-22 is the language. Mm-hmm. Again, we talked earlier about a language. And in Catch-22, and you guys correct me on this, there is the lying in Catch-22, which is to say you fly 25 missions, you get to go home.
Right.
As soon as you fly 25 missions, all of a sudden it becomes 40
right.
missions. You fly your 40 missions, and then it became 60 missions. And then finally, at the end of the novel, it's 80 missions, and you get to go home. And there's this sense of insecurity, total insecurity, and again, generalized anxiety and unbalance. And I think the use of language today, alternate facts, circular logic, which is we're going to do, Don, you know this better than I, we're going to do a new rewrite of the health care bill that we had up before. And we're going to keep pre-existing conditions. However, the insurance companies are going to be allowed to increase costs for pre-existing conditions. And so you're going to get your pre-existing conditions, but you're not going to be able to afford them. And that is right out of Catch-22.
No, I agree.
Right out of Heller's novel,
I think you're right. I think what we've seen in the most recent election cycle, and I think we've been building up to it, is sort of an embracing of the absurd. And I don't necessarily target one side or the other with that, but yeah, sort of a notion that politicians can say things that really have no longer a connection to reality. That they simply can say things, and as long as it's different from what the other side is saying, it serves the same function of sort of dividing people. And I think one of the other things about that notion of absurdity, particularly in that novel, is the resignation that the pilots have to it, because you realize you can't get out of it. Okay, well, it's now. So now it's no longer 25. Now it's this. There is nothing to do. And I think, to go back to what Don was saying about ideology, I think one of the most powerful ideological act someone can do is to convince you that you can't do anything about it. And so, you know, it's amazing how quickly the idea of alternative facts and fake news has just kind of slipped out of the consciousness in some ways. I mean, people were up in arms for a week, but then seemed to have simply accepted the absurdity of it as, well, that's just how politics is these days. And that in some ways, I think, is what is more dangerous about the contemporary we live in, right? The sort of constant news cycle where even very dangerous things about how we speak are quickly forgotten.
Well, that comes to a very, very significant point about the current climate. And that is with the lying, with the current circular logic, and you were hitting on it just now, Adam, what does that do to language and our ability to communicate with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the tricky things, and I think we're seeing more and more of it, right? People used to, we've always had political disagreements, but very often you saw them discussed and debated in sort of public forums. I think we don't really see that anymore. I think with the internet, we have the right going to its websites and sharing all these comments, and the left goes to its websites and shares all these comments, so that we're no longer having a dialogue, right? A notion that different parties need to sort of work together to find common ground as much as it is sort of an acceptance of political divisiveness, right? An acceptance that there will never be peaceful agreement between the parties. And, you know, it's interesting. I think we're even seeing this at a lot of the issues on college campuses these days, sort of discussions about, well, who gets to speak, who is allowed to speak in that sort of sense. And, I mean, again, and this is sort of going back more to 1984, the question of, well, who gets to define what free speech is, right? And proponents on both the left and the right are, you know, having these sort of debates that are both sort of limiting an idea of free speech in some ways, but both feel sort of justified in doing it. And when you see the events on campuses, it's not dialogue. It's just sort of two groups shouting at each other. And it's not, it's no longer intellectual. It's no longer academic, right? I mean, this is the sort of anti-intellectualism where it's just people shouting at each other, right? Which I think is really sad, particularly on college campuses, where that is supposed to be where intellectual ideas are debated, right?
Well, I think the other thing too, and not to be too McLuhan-esque about this, but the modern medium of things, obviously there's blogs, but there's also Twitter. And I think that contributes to a fragmentation, not just simply of views, but fragmentation of language itself.
Yeah.
140 characters, that's it. And so you blast out what you want, and you scream, you yell, you get the most attention, and then you move on.
No, I think you're right. I totally agree with that.
Well, we're going to talk about protest literature on the second program coming up and the third the last, but it has occurred to me, and this is to salt our future conversation a little bit. It has occurred to me that in protest literature, the protest who are first always seem to be the poets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some degree we are experiencing that today, particularly relative to the environment and the denigration of the environment. And Jane Hirschfield is such a poet. And Jane Hirschfield was invited to read a poem at the March for Science on the 22nd, a few days ago. And I would like to end our session today with Hirschfield's poem that will also move us for our next conversation, for the next program. And here is Hirschfield's poem. It's titled On the Fifth Day. Now, remember that on the fifth day in Genesis, the fifth day God created the animals of the earth, the fish, the birds flew for the first time. He created all the animals on the fifth day. On the fifth day, the scientists who studied the rivers were forbidden to speak or to study the rivers. The scientists who studied the air were told not to speak of the air. And the ones who worked for the farmers were silenced. And the ones who worked for the bees. Someone from deep in the Badlands began posting facts. The facts were told not to speak. They were taken away. The facts, surprised to be taken away, were silent. Now it was only the rivers that spoke of the rivers, and only the wind that spoke of its bees, while the unpausing factual buds of the fruit trees continued to move toward their fruit. The silence spoke loudly of silence, and the rivers kept speaking of rivers, of boulders and air. Bound to gravity, earless and tongueless, and untested rivers kept speaking. Bus drivers, shelf stockers, code writers, machinists, accountants, lab techs, cellists kept speaking. They spoke the fifth day of silence. Don Rush, Adam Wood. thank you for this excellent discussion on politics and literature today. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.